As Minnesotans head outdoors this spring and summer, they run the risk of encountering tick-borne illnesses. These infections can have serious long-term consequences. May is Lyme Disease Awareness Month. Next on Access Minnesota, Dr. Elizabeth Maloney from the Minnesota Lyme Association talks about the impact of Lyme disease and how you can avoid infection.
Access Minnesota. Issues that matter to you. Access Minnesota brings you the newsmakers and the stories that shape our everyday lives with analysis from University of Minnesota faculty experts. Access Minnesota is produced by the Minnesota Broadcasters Association in cooperation with the university's College of Liberal Arts and Radio K, KUOM. Now, here's Jim Dubois.
Dr. Elizabeth Maloney is a family practice physician and the president of the Partnership for Tick-Borne Diseases Education. Dr. Maloney, welcome to Access Minnesota.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
First of all, what is Lyme disease?
Well, Lyme disease is a bacterial infection caused by a bacteria called Borrelia burgdorferi, and it can infect any part of the body.
What are the symptoms of Lyme disease? How do we know we've contracted it?
Well, the symptoms are quite variable, and it depends on where that bacteria lands in the body. Common symptoms include a rash that is called the erythema migrans rash, or sometimes abbreviated EM. That tends to be a oval or circular solid-colored rash. And then there are other symptoms such as extreme fatigue. Early on in the illness, someone might have fevers or chills. It's common to have joint complaints like just joint pain or sometimes joint swelling or joint warmth. That would often be referred to as arthritis. We can have muscle pain, headaches. The list can be quite extensive.
How long does it take these symptoms to set in after the tick bite?
Sure. So Lyme is, like as you pointed out, transmitted by ticks. And so when you're bitten by an infected black-legged, or what we in Minnesota call the deer tick, it usually won't have symptoms for the first 7 days, but the symptoms can begin anywhere from 2 to 30 days. Although for some patients, they will not have symptoms for many months to years after the tick bite.
What are the long-term consequences of Lyme disease? What kind of serious impact can it have on a person's quality of life?
Oh, thanks for asking that. So long-term, you can get problems with your joints, so you can get an arthritis that can be long-standing. But the things that we really worry about are when Lyme involves the nervous system. So you can actually get long-term consequences such as a peripheral neuropathy. So you might have numbness or tingling or pain in your peripheral nerves. So you might feel it in your feet and your hands. Or you can get true muscle weakness. You can have trouble with your autonomic nervous system. That's the part of your nervous system that controls all the involuntary things, so it helps maintain our blood pressure, it helps maintain our body temperature, so you can have problems with that. There are some even long-term consequences with the heart.
What are some other diseases that humans can contract from ticks?
Well, that tick can transmit something called anaplasma, which is actually quite common in Minnesota. Anaplasmosis tends to be an acute abrupt illness, so those people will have high fevers and chills, and they also feel very flu-like. That usually starts within a week or two of the tick bite, but we know that anaplasmosis can also cause a chronic infection, and we know that because on occasion there have been transfusion-related cases of anaplasmosis. Another interesting tick-transmitted disease in Minnesota is babesiosis. Babesia is a red blood cell parasite, which is kind of the Midwest equivalent to malaria, which is also a red blood cell parasite. And it has very similar features. It causes shaking chills, but also drenching sweats, especially night sweats. People will in the acute phase of the disease can also develop anemia because the red blood cells will be broken up by the infection.
How prevalent is Lyme disease and other tick-borne diseases in Minnesota?
It's hard, Jim, for us to know about prevalence because we don't even know the incidence of Lyme in our state. And so incidence is how many new cases a year, whereas prevalence is how many total cases, which would include new cases plus the carryover of the people who didn't get well after being treated for Lyme disease. But we know, for instance, in our state, and I had to write down the numbers so I make sure I could get them correctly, that we had 1,806 new cases of Lyme disease in Minnesota in 2015. That's the most recent numbers that we have available. But we know that there is significant underreporting. The CDC estimates that underreporting is usually by about a factor of 10, although one study that our health department did suggested that Minnesota physicians might be better at reporting. But we do know that our numbers are reported really don't tell the whole picture.
Well, the weather is obviously improving. We're in mid-May right now, and we're looking forward to the Memorial Weekend, which is coming up relatively soon. More people are heading outdoors. Where is someone most likely to encounter ticks that could potentially be carrying infections?
Ticks are most likely found in areas that provide moisture, so they dry out easily. And so they prefer to be in the long grass or in that transition zone between wood and lawn. And so you'll see them when you're hiking at the edge of a trail, typically, where you're starting to get the grass growing up. If you have wood piles, either outdoors in hiking situations or in your own backyard, if you have deer in your vicinity, that's where you might find them. You can find ticks at camping grounds, but if you're not a good golfer, you might find a tick on your own golf course. So they're really quite abundant.
We're talking to Dr. Elizabeth Maloney. She is a family practice physician and the president of the Partnership for Tick-Borne Diseases Education. Dr. Maloney, what are some of the best ways to prevent tick bites?
Oh, the first thing is to be aware that you are, if you're, and know where you're going to be. So if you're putting yourself in danger, then you can take that next step, which is to use tick insecticides and repellents. So know if you're going to be in an area that is suitable tick habitat. If you are, you should use clothing that covers as much skin as possible. Ticks don't bite through clothes, so if you've covered up your arms and your legs, you've reduced your risk. Ideally, your clothing should be pretreated with a chemical called permethrin. And permethrin is an insecticide that will bond to your clothing. And once it's dry, it's very safe for you to wear. But when the ticks touch the clothing, they are killed. The nice thing about permethrin is when you put it on your clothing, it usually will be give you protection for up to 6 weeks, depending on what manufacturer. And there are actually, for people who spend a lot of time in the outdoors or a lot of time gardening in areas where the ticks are, you can buy permethrin-embedded clothing, which is good for up to 70 washings. Or as when I talk to the Boy Scouts, they tell me that that's a lifetime.
Dr. Maloney, have cases of Lyme disease been increasing here in Minnesota and throughout the country?
Yes, cases have increased. I would say over the last decade in Minnesota, it's up about 142% from previous averages. And part of that has to do with physician and the public's awareness of Lyme disease. But the other piece of that is that we're just having more interaction. We're going to more places where ticks are, and ticks are expanding their range. So ticks are now found in places where we didn't typically find them 10 years ago.
Do we think that climate change perhaps has any influence on the prevalence of Lyme disease and other tick-borne illnesses?
Well, it has been speculated that climate change has helped the ticks survive better and move north. But, you know, that's a very difficult thing to prove, but that's been getting a lot of ink in scientific journals.
If you find a tick on you, What's the best way to safely remove it?
Well, the first thing I tell people is to get over that ish factor. So if you need to scream or just freak out, do that. But then calm down. And all you need to do is find an implement, and I say a tweezers is just great, and grab that tick as close to your skin as possible, and then pull straight up 90 degrees from your skin straight up. You have to apply a steady traction because these ticks really want to hold on. And if you jerk it off, you're likely to leave the head behind.
Is it a good practice whenever you come from an area where you might be exposed to ticks to do a very thorough body check?
Excellent, Jim. Thanks for bringing that up. So yes, tick checks are part of this layered protection that people need to take in order to keep themselves free of Lyme disease. So you have to peel off all your clothes and throw them in the dryer as soon as you get in, and then head to the bathroom and take a shower if you can, and then examine yourself very carefully because the ticks that you're looking for are quite small. They're about a millimeter. So as one of my patients said when I asked her how she found the tick, she said, well, it was a freckle with legs.
Wow, that's a small insect, isn't it?
That's why it takes time to do a tick. You can't rush a tick check.
Well, you mentioned some of the symptoms of Lyme disease. If you believe you've been bitten by a tick, what signs should you look for in the following days, or as you mentioned with Lyme disease, sometimes weeks or months later? And when should you see a doctor?
Well, if you are bitten by a tick in Minnesota or Wisconsin, and it's a black-legged tick, a deer tick, I suggest that you call your physician immediately, unless it's the middle of the night, and then you can wait till the following morning. And the reason for that is such a high percentage of our ticks carry Lyme disease that it's likely that you would benefit from what we call preventative antibiotic therapy. But if preventative therapy is going to work, it really needs to be administered in the first 48 hours after the bite. And so that's why I don't want you to wait.
Elizabeth Maloney is a family practice physician and the president of the Partnership for Tick-Borne Diseases Education. We're talking about Lyme disease and other tick-borne diseases. Of course, in Minnesota, there are many, many ticks, and some of them can be infected with these diseases. Let's talk about how doctors make a diagnosis for Lyme disease. What sort of tests do they give to the patient?
Well, the first test that they should give is a thorough history and exam, because there are many features to Lyme disease that can tip you off to the diagnosis, such as a known tick bite or the presence of the erythema migrans rash, the EM rash. But there are other things that they can ask for, too. For instance, have other family members been diagnosed with a tick-borne disease? Or conversely, because the goal is to get everyone diagnosed correctly, they should also ask questions that would help them eliminate Lyme disease. And then they can do a physical exam and look for a variety of findings that we see in Lyme disease, the arthritis that can come from Lyme disease, the skin changes that can come from Lyme disease, trouble with maintaining blood pressure, all the things that we would think of that Lyme can cause.
Is there a definitive blood test for Lyme disease or no?
No, there's not, which is why I didn't leap to that part of the question. So the blood testing for Lyme disease is an interesting issue, and it's because the tests are very specific, meaning they really only find people with the disease. The downside or the flip side of that is they're not very sensitive, which means that they often miss people who do have the disease. Now, if I'm a researcher, I want specific testing because I don't want people in my study who don't have Lyme disease. But if I'm acting as a clinician, I want a test that's very sensitive because I don't want to miss Lyme disease and make it harder for that patient to get diagnosed. And I also don't want that to happen such that their treatment is delayed, because we know that treatment delay comes with a worse outcome.
Once a diagnosis of Lyme disease is made, how is it treated?
The treatment for Lyme disease is like how we treat any other bacterial infection, and that's with antibiotics. Not all antibiotics work for Lyme disease, but some common ones that we use are doxycycline or any member of the tetracycline group. You can use amoxicillin. You can use something called Ceftin. There are other antibiotics that are more commonly used in Europe, such as azithromycin or Zithromax, and sometimes they'll use Biaxin.
Is Lyme disease hard to identify, and what can make the disease so complicated to diagnose and treat?
It's very difficult to identify, and so a good portion of what I do is try to educate physicians on how to recognize the patterns of Lyme disease. And so the reason it's difficult to identify is that the symptoms are nonspecific, so you can see the same symptoms in other illnesses. And you can see sometimes the same physical exam findings. And so you have to gather all the little pieces. And as soon as you get enough pieces together, then you can kind of figure out what the puzzle of this is. And so it can be very difficult. And I don't criticize my colleagues who miss cases, but I encourage them to get more experience or more teaching on Lyme disease so they'll be better able to pick up that pattern.
Well, now that we've been hearing more about Lyme disease over the years, are medical schools spending more time teaching future doctors about the disease and how to treat it?
Well, I'm not in medical school anymore, so I can't say. But I can say that about 5 years ago, I know the University of Minnesota was not doing a very good job. And I did get an opportunity to see the curriculum that the second-year students were exposed to. And I'm afraid to say that it was not evidence-based. It certainly didn't reflect the newest evidence. And I'm afraid that there might be a bias against Lyme disease in many medical schools.
Let's talk about that for a moment. What is the nature of that bias, and why is there some controversy surrounding Lyme disease?
The nature of the bias is that it's a complex disease that's poorly understood on a scientific basis, and so that introduces a lot of uncertainty. And physicians don't deal well with uncertainty, you know, and we're supposed to be the experts. And so when we're kind of pushed into a gray zone, people will take different approaches to how to deal with scientific uncertainty. As different people have staked out how they're going to behave, they're trying to mandate that everyone behave the way I do. So some people say, well, I'm not sure what to do, so I'm not going to do anything, and I'm going to wait for the research. And while I understand that approach, the patient in front of you cannot wait for the research. And so we have to find a way to act on the things that we do know. And there is enough evidence now to guide our choices. And so I like to expose my colleagues to the evidence we have now.
We're talking with Dr. Elizabeth Maloney. She is a family practice physician and the president of the Partnership for Tick-Borne Diseases Education. Dr. Maloney, following up on that last question, patients are doing a better job of educating themselves, probably to the chagrin of some doctors because the patient may have spent too much time online and come in with ideas about diseases they may not even have. But that information that's now so readily available does help patients ask better questions of their care providers and make them a better informed patient when they come in to visit a medical professional. This might be a delicate situation, but if you have a suspicion that you might have Lyme disease, is it a fair question to ask your healthcare provider, what do you think about Lyme disease, and will you give me the tests that are necessary to try and help determine this? Is that a discussion that patients should have, given the fact that some healthcare providers are not familiar with Lyme disease or may even not be very good at diagnosing it?
Well, this is a great question, and I'm actually writing up a presentation on this topic. And so one of the things is in that patient-physician relationship, there is kind of a dynamic and certain roles. And so the patient's role is they're the expert on themselves. They can report to us what they've observed about themselves, as well as, you know, all of the other things, where they live, what they do, things of that nature. Physicians are supposed to be the experts on the medical information. So when we have a situation where patients feel that they're better informed than their physician, it can set up conflict, especially if that happens to be the case. The trick, though, is coming from a physician perspective, is a patient might have done a lot of research on Lyme and really know that. But because Lyme mimics so many other diseases, they really can't diagnose themselves with Lyme disease or other people because they don't know all the other diseases that they have to think about and rule out before you arrive at a Lyme diagnosis. And so I think rather than coming in and trying to put blinders on your physician as, do I have Lyme disease, you're really better to start with, these are my symptoms, doctor. What do you think they could be? So let your physician come at it with an open mind. And then if you feel like you've danced around the topic of Lyme disease and that's what you're interested, you could, when they give you a list of it could be this, that, or the other thing, it's like, well, what else might it be? Could this be an infection? You can kind of lead them without coming out, is this Lyme? Because I think to do that is probably not going to get you where you want to go. And because I'm not a big believer in the blood tests, because and by believer, I mean I don't often recommend that we put our trust in the blood tests because I know their fallibilities. I would rather people not come right out and ask for a blood test.
Do you see more physicians coming in for continuing education or special courses or special presentations to find out more about this disease? You mentioned that some medical schools really aren't focusing very heavily on it, but are more doctors seeking out additional education on Lyme disease?
Well, there's a slow movement in that way. And so that conferences that are feature Lyme disease as a topic or tick-borne diseases are increasingly popular. Columbia University has run a conference on Lyme and other tick-borne diseases. I think they're in their 17th or 18th year. And they are really, we're seeing more physicians come to those conferences. And those are generally research-based conferences, but they have a clinical component as well. I'm always trying to educate my physician colleagues, and so I do give live presentations at grand rounds or full-day seminars. But physicians are busy, and they have different schedules. And so now I'm offering accredited courses on Lyme disease via the Internet. And so that website has got an easy name for my colleagues to remember. It's www.lymecme.info. So lymecme.info. And there they can select from a wide variety of modules. Some of them are worth 1.5 credits. Others go up to 2.5 credits. So they can accumulate a lot of credits, and they need those credits. But more importantly, they can see what the scientific evidence is. I've tried very careful to not spin the evidence. I just want to lay out the facts as they are.
Dr. Maloney, you mentioned earlier that Lyme disease can have some very severe consequences. What are some of the most extreme cases of patient impact that you've seen from Lyme disease?
Well, the ones that I've seen, probably the most extreme, are the patients who develop neuromuscular problems from Lyme disease. So these are the people that lose the ability to walk, people who lose fine motor control, people with cognitive issues. So I know an architect that had to retire because he kept transposing numbers no matter how hard he tried. People who were public speakers who developed language issues, and so they can't speak spontaneously for fear that they're going to blurt out the wrong word. Last year, or in 2015 in Minnesota, there was a death due to Lyme disease because it was an infection that involved the heart. I've seen people who have needed to have, who were on the verge of needing temporary pacemakers because the heart rhythm was disturbed by their Lyme infection. In the one case I was most involved with, thankfully, he did not need a pacemaker, and that was great. But I've seen some pretty severe illness from Lyme disease. The good news, though, and the one I like to hold out to patients, is I have seen very ill people come a long way back when they've been treated for Lyme disease. although their treatment might extend much longer than my colleagues would guess.
Where are some good sources of information about Lyme disease and treatment of Lyme disease and other tick-borne illnesses?
Well, I like to think that my website, Partnership for Tick-Borne Diseases Education.org, is one good place. It's, again, a spin-free place. Columbia University, its website, Columbia University Tick Research Center website, is a good one. I think that parts of the CDC website are good. I think where I would disagree would be over areas of testing and treatment. The Lyme Disease Association has a good website. Minnesota Lyme is working on their website. So there's a variety. What I would caution against is websites that spin conspiracy theories or things of that nature.
Dr. Elizabeth Baloney is a family practice physician and the president of the Partnership for Tick-Borne Diseases Education. Dr. Maloney, thanks so much for joining us on Access Minnesota.
My pleasure. Thanks, Jim.
Access Minnesota will return after these messages.